The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
This is the third week of my four-week intensive workshop that's teaching how to buy your first out-of-state investment property. This week, we went over how to find and analyze properties, and it was an amazing class. I had so much fun, and so did everyone who was there. And so if you want to join the workshop, it is not too late. You can still join and get access to the replays of any sessions that you may have missed. Next week, we're going to go over how to creatively finance your properties. All right. So if you're interested and if you're sick of the expensive market you live in and you want to learn how to buy affordable investment properties, go to outofstatemoney.com/workshop or click the link in the description of this episode. We'll see you there. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 190. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. If you haven't already, please take a moment to leave a 5-star rating and review wherever you're listening to this show. It helps us go from the rankings, helps us to reach more people and spread this message all over the world. And if you do leave a 5-star rating and review, send me an email. My email is in the show notes of this episode, and I'll reply back by sending you a free training on how to find and analyze properties. So definitely looking forward to hearing from you. And another quick announcement, things are going well with my properties out in Ohio. I just got the gutters cleaned over the weekend. One of the tenants at the first place sent me some pictures of a fence, the privacy fence. Part of it is wood and it looks like it is rotting away. So I need to look into that. You mentioned a storm got rid of some of the planks. So not a super emergency, but it is something I need to get somebody to take a look at. So I'll keep you posted on that. Very excited about this episode with my guy, Dominique Remy. He started out as a teacher, making not a lot of money, in about 2009, and he started investing in real estate a couple of years later. Then he eventually got into real estate development, and right now he's working on building 99 units up in the Seattle area. So it's an amazing story, inspirational story. So without further ado, let's get into it. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video, share this video, and subscribe to the channel for more real estate content. If you're on the audio side, make sure you leave us that 5-star rating and review. Very excited for this interview today. Here with me, I have my guy, Dominique Remy. Dominique, thank you so much for joining the show today, man.
Hey, man. I'm super excited to be here. So, yeah, really excited.
Definitely. And shout out to Mark. Shout out to Mark for putting us in contact earlier this year. good dude, man. And shout out to Mark. If you're out there somewhere watching, you're probably getting money somewhere.
But yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. I'm excited to see him. Actually, I'm going to meet up with him tomorrow, I think. So
dope. Yeah. Dope. Awesome, man. So, Dom, thank you again. And I know you have about 100 units being developed right now. So congrats on that. The first thing I want to talk about, we'll definitely get into the details of that. But the first thing I want to talk about, one of the things you mentioned to me when we were talking before was just your strategy for acquiring houses with lots on them. And it's a strategy I never heard before. I would love if you could dive into that a little bit.
Man, so interesting, because I was talking to people recently. I was saying, I got to come up with a name for the strategy, because, you know, all those other strategies have like very specific names, you know, covered land play, you know, burr strategy. But yeah, so one of the strategies that I've used a lot is still one of my favorite ones. It's not necessarily where I do the most of my investment today. But it's effectively to buy a house that's in, you know, a value add house. It likely needs some repairs, but it needs to be on a very large lot. So we're not talking a 5,000 square foot lot. We're not talking a 4,000 square foot lot. I'm generally looking for, you know, minimum, you know, a third of an acre. I'm looking for a minimum of 15,000 square feet. Ideally, I can get up to a full acre if possible. And most importantly, it needs to be zoned correctly. The hope is that I can go through the process of subdividing that lot. So for example, one of the projects that I built, down in the Lakewood, Washington area, we bought a house on a large lot. It was actually, the lot was spec'd at 11,000 square feet. Originally, that's what they had listed. And there was a house on there. It was in kind of rough shape. And what they actually didn't realize is this is why it's so important. You got to go, you got to do your homework. You got to get into the code. You have to do your due diligence. They actually didn't realize that they had a 10 foot by 100 foot easement on that property. Well, that may not sound like it's a big deal up front, but that lot was zoned MR3, which has a minimum, lot size requirement of 3,000 square feet. And so in buying this, I bought that house for $200,000. We knew that we could, at the beginning, we thought we could go through the process of subdividing into three different lots. But because we had found out that there is a 10 foot by 100 foot vacated easement that actually gave us another 1,000 square feet, which put us to 12,000 square feet, allowed us to get four houses on that. And the reason why that's one of my favorite strategies is now my cost per building is now significantly smaller. So what we ended up doing, we subdivided each lot 3,000 square feet, as previously mentioned, and built four new construction houses on there. Each house cost us about $225,000. And so our total cost all in was about $275,000. We ended up selling each house for about $600,000. And so when you look at that, we ended up ultimately netting a little bit, you know, right around $1.2 million on that over a 2.5 year period. And you think about that, that's because of the fact that our lot cost was so much smaller. And one of the reasons why I like that strategy is I jokingly mentioned, so that includes a covered land play. Primarily, we were able to keep a renter in that house the whole period of time. And then that renter, they continue to pay, you know, for our property taxes. They continue to pay for insurance. If we're able to, you know, eke a little bit of margin out on that in the meanwhile, they also help for us to pay for permitting and for all of the different pre-construction work that has to happen, you know. So again, it leaves us with very little out of pocket while we're waiting to get everything set up. That's one of your biggest risks on a project, and ultimately leads to a really sweet outcome on the inside. So
I like that. I like that. So I'll recap, and you correct me if I'm wrong. I'm trying to learn too. So yeah. Pretty much you buy a property that has ideally about an acre of land. Ish, and then
just generally more your typical lot size for single family homes are around 5,000 square feet. Depends on the community. Some of them mm-hmm. can be as, you know, as high as 8,000, but we want to make sure that we can build at least 2 to 3 houses on a lot minimum. Yeah. And now actually that was in the very beginning. Now I actually don't even look at a lot if I can't do at least 4, you know? Yeah. So, I have a few that I have in the pipeline, where I'll be doing 3, unfortunately, but that's also, you know, in Seattle, in our particular community, our area, they did a lot to improve the ADU, codes. So, you know, I'm currently doing a project, same thing, but a half acre. There's already 3 existing structures on there. One of the houses is a teardown, just no question. We could not rehabilitate that. The other two, I put about $10,000 into renovating them, got them set up as Airbnbs. They cash flow, again, cover the property taxes, cover the insurance, cover a lot of my early construction costs, planning and consultant costs and whatnot. And so the long-term plan is to ultimately, once we get all of our permits in place, tear down all 3 of the properties, new construction on all 3 of those lots. But we can also do a detached ADU for each one of those as well. So if we want, we can get up to 6 units on what was, again, previously a single tax parcel. So, yeah. And that's one of my favorite strategies. Just because, again, I'm able to take, I think I bought that lot for 935,000. If you think about it again, that's already broken down into three. You're now at 310,000 in this neighborhood. Houses sell for about 1.5 mil. And so that's our planned exit right now. We're currently in, I currently have architectural plans for about 3,300 square foot house. And yeah, I'm hoping to ultimately net about a little over 1.5 on that when that's said and done. So
I love that. I love that. Yeah. So, you know, what I'm thinking about is, you know, if someone is buying a single family residence or multi, whatever it is, it sounds like it's smart to buy it with the proper zoning and also with land on it in the event that you want to develop, and or I would assume it would increase the resale value if the person buying it knows that they can maybe tear down and build several new homes on it, or build a home, you know, to the side or a couple in the back, right?
Land is everything, man. I think it's there are two things that I think aren't talked about nearly enough in the whole real estate. I would say they're not talked about enough when you see and hear people in the social world talking about real estate.
Yeah.
Because if you go and you talk to any of the old heads, man, they'll tell you it's about zoning and it's about land. At the end of the day, those are the two things that are going to have some of the highest leverage on your actual outcomes. And so, my dad, I'm blessed. My dad, he's a real estate developer. I've had a chance to learn from him, to pick his brain, to ask questions over and over again. And to hear kind of the same mantras that he's been telling me ever since I was, you know, 10 years old. I kid you not, my dad, when I was like, in third grade, was trying to teach me about time value of money and trying to show me, you know, the dollar cost averaging and all these different details that just really helped me to think very differently about this. But a really good example of this is understanding, being really deep in your understanding of the code. Yeah,
definitely. Can you explain at a basic level zoning for those who may not be familiar with that concept?
Yeah. Man, I love that. I love that you asked that. One of my favorite conversations is to talk to people about zoning. And one of the reasons why is it ties very well into the history of us as Black people. If you travel to a lot of international countries, I've had a few trips out to Thailand and to Vietnam, you'll find they don't really have zoning in some places. You can have a high rise right next to a single family house, right next to a mall. And that's not uncommon. Zoning, ironically, is actually about the process of reducing what can be built on a property. It's effectively saying that we're going to constrain what is actually possible in this particular place. It's generally how many communities in the U.S., one of the largest tools many communities in the U.S. use to be able to enforce segregation. And is why it's like so critical for us as Black people to understand zoning and the impacts on us. It was, in addition to redlining, it was one of the most fundamental tools in ensuring that we were able to, communities were able to ensure that their community stayed white or stayed a particular type of way. On the single family side, that particular single family zoning has been used primarily to ensure that we got suburbs and to ensure that we had, it's kind of no different than an HOA, right? Where you have very specific requirements about what can be built, what can't be built, you know, how big a house can be, you know, what you can, what materials can be used for a house, what the style of the roofs are that are allowed for a particular house. All of that you can find in zoning codes. Minimum, your minimum lot size, minimum lot width. We don't just have randomness in housing in particular neighborhoods, primarily because of zoning. However, most of the original areas that were predominantly Black, predominantly Chinese, Japanese. Those places were oftentimes zoned industrially and zoned commercially. And so ironically, one of the things that you see right now is that there's been kind of a renaissance in understanding the value of zoning, because you see a lot of gentrification today happens because individuals are buying are buying lots in places that have commercial and industrial zoning, because that allows for you to be able to do the most different type of things with that lot. So if you look at North Portland, if you look at South Seattle, you see that that's a lot of what's happening. Ironically, one of the cities that, if I remember correctly, and I don't quote me on this, but if I remember correctly, one of the cities that has some of the least amount of zoning is Houston. And so there's a lot of individuals that like to buy and build out in Houston, primarily because they don't have the same constraints.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Like, I know a bunch of people, developers down in Houston. It's a great time. It's a great time, man.
And a lot easier.
Yeah. A lot less red tape than places like California or, you know, other states.
Yeah. I got to add one additional thing, though, which is also the other element that's really important to zoning, is the history of safety regulations, fire, ensuring the health elements, sanitation, that before there was broad and mass zoning, it's kind of, you know, what can happen will happen, right? It's a little bit of Moore's law in that regard. And so, because of that, or Murphy's law, pardon me. And because of that, they started incorporating zoning to ensure that individuals who were building weren't trying to pack, you know, eight families into effectively a four unit complex, like you would see happening back in the early 1900s in New York. So a lot of the advances in sanitation, same thing. I was just reading about there being I forget the name of it, but there was in the early 1913 in New York City, there was a massive fire that led to more than 100 plus people dying in that building in the fire. And one of the reasons why those people died in that building in the fire is because the employers locked all the doors from the outside. And that was not uncommon at that time in American history.
My goodness.
Because there was a concern that employees would leave and they would not actually do the work that was at hand. And so that led to a lot of the things that we see in the code today, specifically regarding egress, specifically regarding exit signs and fire extinguishers and evacuation paths and all these different things that we see today. So that is also an element that we see involved in the codes.
Definitely. Well, that's a lesson right there. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. So one of the things we spoke about too is first time I've heard this, you mentioned that in your opinion, development is less competitive than, say, like buying and holding a property. Can you talk some more about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the reasons I love development is because you kind of get to do a little bit of everything. You know, you're involved very much on the acquisition side, finding the right properties, due diligence. You are involved working with your, finance partners, potentially LPs and investors. Bringing those individuals to the table as a GP. You're involved with your architects. You're developing the vision for what's possible with this particular property that you have. And then you're ultimately trying to ensure that you can get that built, you know, and doing a lot of the site development work, bringing on a GC to ultimately do the new construction, and then getting that out to sale. And so as a developer, that's a lot of different skill sets you have to have. And that alone weeds out a lot of individuals. it's not necessarily the easiest element, but more often than not, when you're a developer, you have some of the highest returns that you can gain of all the different ways you can make money in real estate. But because of that, there are not a lot of people that typically want to get in at that level in terms of what it takes to be able to do it, whether it be new construction, whether it be site development work. Versus, also typically when you're developing, you know, you're doing more than one unit, right? And so because of that, there's also a scale element that requires some additional capital beyond what's required for flipping. And so all of those things kind of filter out who ends up in the developer space. It's why we need more Black developers. There are a number of reasons why we don't have as many developers today that are Black that are tied to all of those different kind of filters that ultimately end up happening. So
Yeah. In your opinion, why do we have so few Black developers? What's a couple of reasons you think are prevalent?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a number of reasons. One, I believe, is access to capital. That when you are, you know, whenever you're working, whenever you're developing, especially, for example, a multifamily, you're typically needing to be a guarantor on the loan, right? You need to be able to have a personal financial statement that demonstrates your existing capital that you have. And your ability that in the event that this was to fail, that you would be able, that the bank could effectively take something. access to capital and the role that banks have played historically has been, again, one of the larger areas of friction and pain point for Black developers to be able to get into that space. The second thing is not necessarily something that you go to school for. There's not a particular, there's not like a major in development. You can do construction management, but again, because development is kind of doing, you're kind of working across all elements of the full vertical of real estate. It requires that you have access to networks. It requires that you have access, and exposure to what's happening in that particular community and in other communities having a vision for what's possible to build. And so those are areas where I feel like we just have not necessarily, been able to create the foundation necessary in order for people to get there. And most often people will come into development from flipping. People come into development, from being a real estate agent or a broker. People come in from the trades, right? I've already been owning a concrete company, you know, and I've actually started thinking to myself, oh, I should actually think about vertically integrating across other trades. And actually I might as well start building things as well, right? This is not uncommon for individuals in the trades to start realizing that they could actually be involved as a builder developer. And so, but it almost always means that you have to have capital to start.
Yeah. That makes sense. What's worked for you in terms of like raising capital?
It's a great question. We only syndicate about 25% of the deals of the properties that we'd work on, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not oftentimes raising a lot of money from LPs. But we do have some fantastic LPs and investors with us on a few of the projects that we do. I'd probably start off really with one of the biggest, you know, chunks of the pie, right, is your banking partners. We are blessed. We have some of the best banking partners that we get a chance to work with. I regularly talk about the importance of making sure that, you know, you match the property and what you are planning to do with it with the right funding, right? You know, there are times for hard money. There are times for using a bank. There's times to bring in, LPs and investors. There's times to just do promissory notes, right? There are times for each of those different tools, and you got to be able to know when is the right time to use each of those different tools, depending on what outcomes you're trying to accomplish. And what I've found is that we traditionally like to use local banks by far the most. They are embedded in the community. They're invested in the community. They want to see outcomes that are a win for the community. When things start to go wrong, and invariably they will, if you're in the business long enough, you're going to have, you know, the fastest increase in inflation, that one has ever seen. You're going to have supply chain shortages. You're going to have, recessions that you're going to have to face in headwinds. You want, banking partners that are going to have your back and that are going to be there, pounding the table on your behalf and the conversations that matter when you're not there. And so we work with, three different, local community banks up in the, Seattle, and Tacoma, Washington area. And we do a lot to ensure that, what we do isn't hidden behind cloaks. Right. We regularly bring them out on site. We probably beyond just banks will already have kind of a monthly inspection of your construction just to make sure that things are kind of progressing as you're saying they are, as you're doing your construction draws and whatnot. But We go beyond that. We want to have them on site. We want to show them the progress that's happening. We give them access to our, to our inventories. We walk them through where we're at on our budget. We ensure we have a very clear and solid narrative of what we're trying to accomplish.
I think we've
talked previously. I used to be a product manager in mm-hmm. tech. And one of the things that we used to talk about is we want to always make the user the hero of their own story, right? And so when we think about how we work with our banking partners or any of our investors for that matter, that's commonly exactly what we have in our mind is how do we make them the hero of their own story? Because of you, this community is getting X number of units. Because of you, we're raising the bar in terms of what living and lifestyles look like in this community. Because of what you are putting forth, and you're turning a profit at the same point in time. Yeah. So that is a huge part of how we think about bringing in the right people, financing, ensuring that we're able to get the runway to do the things that we're doing. So
definitely, man, I love that. I love that. So one of the things I would love to get into. So when you moved back to Seattle, how did you start to gain your own firsthand experience with development before you started taking on your own projects?
It's a great, great question. I think this is like a super helpful, like way to think about it. Cause I think a lot of times people are always like, how do I get started? What's the best way for me to get into real estate? And you know, when I moved back to Seattle from Las Vegas, I'd already owned two properties at that point in time. So part of me was like, man, all right, I kind of got this, right? I was a little sophomore. I was like, I got this and I know about property. Now I'm getting into the game. I see it. When moving from Vegas to Seattle is very different. That market up in Seattle is a lot more expensive than that market in Vegas was. Yeah. Our two houses we bought in Vegas, I bought my first one for essentially $150,000. Next house we bought in Vegas, $121,000. These were both four bedroom, you know, 3.5 bath. Both of them have pools and hot tubs. You know, these are nice houses, but we got them at, 2011, 2013 in Las Vegas was a good time to be buying. So we wanted to go up to Seattle and wanted to buy our first investment property. But even though I was from the Seattle area, Seattle had changed so much since I lived there. It was really clear to me that I didn't know exactly where the best places were to invest. And so I started looking in certain communities, started looking in Beacon Hill, looked in Georgetown. And I was like, oh man, these houses are going for like $450,000. This is a 3X increase on the cost than what I was doing on Vegas. And that was actually very scary at first. Mm-hmm. No different than when I bought my first house. The first time I bought my first house at $150,000, I was deathly scared because I was like, those were the biggest numbers I had seen at that point in my life. And you're like, man, I can't mess this up. And one of the things I used mentally to get over that fear was to say, hey, look, Dom, one day you're going to be a millionaire. One day you're going to be at this level. These numbers are going to be a drop in the bucket based off of where I ultimately want to be. And I need to get comfortable with numbers at that size. I need to get comfortable with $100,000. I need to get comfortable with $1 million. I need to get comfortable at the $10 million phase. So I had to really talk myself into, how am I going to be comfortable at $400,000, which seemed just absurd to me at the time. And now properties in Vegas are going for $400,000. But at the time, we rented an apartment, much to my chagrin. And I was talking to my dad about how I was really interested in trying to get into the property in Seattle. And he said, well, one of the best ways you can do that is to learn from other flippers and developers that are already doing this in the community. And I said, well, that's a great idea. And I was like, are there any ways that you can think of? He's like, well, I can introduce you to a few of my buddies that are flipping and developing. And what if you were to do some promissory notes with them? And for those that don't know what a promissory note is, all it is effectively a mortgage, right? Effectively, if I am a flipper, and let's say I'm trying to exit on this property that I bought within 9 months, I borrowed, a couple $100,000 from this hard money loan program or company. but I am short by $20,000. Things, you know, cost a little bit more than expected. Instead of me going back to that bank and asking them for more money, which, you know, you'll likely have an extension cost, you may have origination costs. Instead, what you will do is you can effectively get investment from other individuals, and typically in the form of what's known as a promissory note. And that effectively it becomes no different than any other bank doing it. But an individual that's giving you money, they're not gonna, you know, look up your credit score and ding you on your credit, right? They're doing it semi based on the relationship, knowing that they can trust you. But at the same point in time, we would always do our promissory notes as secured promissory notes. So we would oftentimes secure it against the collateral of that property that they were working against. We'd make sure that that's recorded with the county so that in the event that they actually couldn't complete that project, if that property ended up being foreclosed upon, we would be essentially the second mortgage on that property. And if it had to be sold, there is the potential that we could get something back. It's not a guarantee. You're in second position after the initial bank or whoever is recorded on that particular property. Very important. If you ever do promissory notes, make sure that they're secured. So that's what I did. Essentially, my first 2 years out in Seattle, probably five different flippers. I had made some good money in real estate down in Vegas, and so somebody needed $35,000 on a project over here. Let's do a 6 month promissory note. Typically, terms would be 2% origination as a fee to myself, and then 1% a month. So, you're looking at roughly 14% over the cost of the year. And that's a great way for me to be able to make good money, some good returns. But most importantly, was actually being able to see the property that they were using that money on, going with them to the property to see their vision, getting a chance to meet their subs, to meet their GCs, getting a chance to ask questions about why did they choose this particular property over alternatives? Why were they in this neighborhood? Really starting to pick the brains. And they had a vested interest in giving me all this information because I was giving them money. and so That was a strategy that I used that was incredibly effective. It helped me to grow my bankroll a little bit, gave me a lot more confidence in what I was seeing in different communities, and it helped me figure out exactly where and how I wanted to invest in the Seattle community. So,
definitely, I love that. And shout out to your dad for giving you that advice. You'd benefit in multiple ways. You made money, right?
Yep.
By lending it out.
Yep.
And then you also took advantage of that and got the hands-on experience and got to understand the inner workings of everything, the construction, just how they're doing everything before you dive into it yourself. So I think that was a great move.
Back when I was a teacher, one of the things that we would do is we'd do class visits. So, when you're on your break, you're trying to become a good teacher. You would actually go to another classroom to go observe what a master teacher actually looks like. So that way you could be like, oh man, like I didn't realize that they're teaching this exact same subject I'm teaching, but they're doing it this way. And doing something like promissory notes early on, getting a chance to go and observe how other master flippers were thinking about their numbers, how they're calculating their expenses, how they were navigating their relationships with their bankers. That was like my classroom visits, so to speak.
Yeah. Love it, man. I think that's a great connection between skills you learn on your job that can translate into real estate because you did the exact same thing. Now it's just for something you can make a lot more money doing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And what you start realizing is, as you grow and scale, you're really just doing the same thing. You're just doing it on more properties or with a larger budget. Right. And we jokingly talk about this. Generally, the amount of time it'll take for me to get permitted and the amount of time it'll take me to build a, 30 unit multifamily versus building a single house is slightly different. One might take 50% longer, but the return on outcome is way different than 50%. And so you start realizing that that's how most people end up going from flipping into development, because you realize, hey, look, I'm doing this a lot and it's really hard, and you have to have a lot of things that work out just right. And also, flipping can be really capital intensive, because remember, everything you're doing, you have to come out of pocket first. And then the bank reimburses you as a part of the construction draw. And so, And you have to move fast while you're flipping as well. This is actually one of the main reasons I also liked going into development. I like that essentially I could have multiple properties on a 2 to 3 year timeline as opposed to trying to exit within 6 to 9 months. And I've found that, having that longer timeline, it also makes it easier for us to be able to weather the storm in the event that the broader market or the economy is going through some things. Because I know that I can slow up if need be. I know that I can speed up if need be. But overarchingly, you know, a recession is going to last, you know, for only so long, right? Mm-hmm. A supply chain shortage is only going to last for so long. And generally, my projects are going to take a little bit longer than the whole portion of that. So
definitely yeah. Smart. You're a very analytical guy.
I can tell. Man, thank you. Yeah, no, it's again, it's just for myself, I definitely didn't start out that way.
Yeah.
But my experience in the classroom, the program I was with, Teach for America, was very, very big on using data to inform all decisions mm-hmm. and thought processes. And then most recently, I worked at Facebook as a product manager on Newsfeed. And same thing, we would look at over 100 metrics before making a go decision for any particular test. And so that just becomes ingrained in you with the way in which you start to think about all of the different decisions that go into each of the different properties that we build. So.
Definitely, man. So talk a little bit more about the projects you got going on right now.
Yeah, man. Okay. So, one of the projects we're building right now, is a 63 unit multifamily. It's, 3 buildings, 21 units each. It's a walk up low rise multifamily. So no elevators, 3 floors. And it's an awesome project. I'm very big into modern design. So all, you know, say 80 to 90% of the projects in the properties I build are modern. Kind of going back to the analytical and data, about 4 years ago in the Seattle area, I started looking specifically, I pulled comp data for properties of the same bedrooms, bathrooms, square footage that were newly constructed and were modern versus those that were newly constructed and were traditional. And what I found was that the modern properties, again, this was 5 years ago, I don't know how well this has held up more recently because now modern is just about everywhere, that the modern properties sold at a near 30 to 40% premium with exact same square footage, bedrooms, bathrooms, garages. And it became very clear to me that it would make no sense to build anything other than modern properties. Mm-hmm. In addition, there's a lot of nuances about modern aesthetics that actually lead to a lower cost. Because if you think about old school, you know, craftsman, traditional, there's a lot of fine detailing. And modernity is really about the removing of visual elements and distractions towards simplicity. Simplicity means you actually get to use less. Whether it be everything from a baseboard profile being a lot more standard in terms of its approach, you know, just a straight rectangle versus having multiple kind of undulations and modulations on it, all the way through to the doors that you buy, you know, all the way through to a number of different kind of elements. You end up finding out that you can actually save money on certain things by going with a more modern design build approach. So that's what we've incorporated on things on our projects is how do we incorporate modernity into it? How do we incorporate elements of bringing nature in? So we like to do all of our multifamilies. We do 9 foot ceilings. When you walk in, it feels grandiose. We do oversized windows, so we typically have large glazing. That way you really feel like you're taking the nature in with you. On this project, I'm really excited. We're actually doing our first EV chargers. We're going to end up having, I think, 14 EV chargers on site, which is a really big deal. And then we do all the other stuff, man. We want to make sure that our properties feel good to people. You know, so quartz countertops, you know, luxury vinyl plank flooring. One of my little hacks that I like to do, you know, if we're going to do 9 foot ceilings, we should take advantage of that. So, traditionally your shower heads for most, for most bathrooms are placed at about 80 inches tall or so. Mm-hmm. I always like to put them up at 86 inches tall. I'm not the tallest dude out there, but I know that when that feels like it's coming from a higher place, mm-hmm. especially if you're a tall guy, that's one of those small details that you notice that makes a place feel slightly a little bit more luxurious. We do the same thing with the bathroom vanities as well, again, so that you have a more cascading light. Yeah, so that particular property is one I'm very excited about. It's going to be a gated community. We have a one-to-one parking on it. Parking, going back to zoning, is one of the most important things when you start developing, understanding what your parking constraints are. That oftentimes will dictate truly what you can build on a particular lot. That as well as what local transportation looks like. If you have bus stops nearby or, you know, a light rail station or something to that extent, that truly can change your entire unit mix and composition in and of itself. And that's one of the things that we think very critically about. One of the things that I was really thought that was really intentional about this particular multifamily is that we designed these during COVID, and we got to remember that so much of our realities are influenced by the things that impact us. Yep. And you know what happened during COVID was everybody was stuck inside.
Yep.
Right. And so being stuck inside meant that people wanted to get out. That's a lot of where ensuring that it feels very nature inspired is top of mind for us. People wanted bigger spaces. So we have our unit mix. We have 5 1-bedrooms and we have 2 2-bedrooms per floor. But one of our 2-bedrooms has a den and one of our 1-bedrooms has a den. And we incorporated dens more because we realized that people wanted to have that and were willing to pay to have that extra space coming out on the other side of COVID. And so that's that particular particular project. We're really excited about that. This is a great example of just, you know, you have to work kind of all things from different angles. We originally were able to buy the lots that we're building on today. We bought them for, I want to say, around $600,000. It's actually 3 separate lots. We bought each lot, $150,000 the first time around, $150,000 the second time around, you know, $300,000 the third time around, in order to be able to create an assemblage of about 1.5 acres. And we bought them from a church. Absolutely fantastic church. We're so happy that we can provide additional housing in this community. And again, this goes back to how do we help make people the heroes of their own stories? Us adding, you know, 63 units, potentially 126, you know, adults in this particular community, that's a lot more additional people that could potentially attend that church. Mm-hmm. for that particular project, you know, we have a little over $9.5 million construction budget on that. We're tracking to be on budget, which is pretty impressive given all the craziness that's happened. So,
yeah. Man, that's awesome. That's awesome. What's the timeline left on that one?
Yeah. So we just started flooring and cabinets. I'll make sure to shoot you some photos and whatnot.
Well, you got to,
so that
man.
Way we can throw that on.
Yeah.
All the stuff. We just started flooring, cabinets. We just finished paint. We're doing electrical trim out, mechanical trim out, of fire alarm trim out, and you know, a lot of the exterior landscaping, et cetera, right now. So we're really close. We think we're going to be leasing up here. I'd say end of October. I think we're probably about a month out for the first building, and then the other 2 buildings will kind of roll out behind that. So, it's actually pretty cool. I've been given some talks recently about how do we incorporate. I'm former tech, right? So how do we incorporate real estate and AI together? And for this particular project and a sister project, it's 36 units. It's about 1/2 mile down the road. I actually leveraged a number of different AI tools to ultimately go through a rebrand of these particular projects. As we were looking at what we were building, as they're coming up and they're getting vertical and the hardy panels going on it and the windows are going in, we're like, man, these are beautiful. I'm looking at the names that we originally had for them, and I'm like, these names don't fit. We got to find something that feels more modern, that feels more connected towards our community. that aren't as long. The names we had were very long. I think it was like one was 19 characters, the other one was 21 characters or something like that. So I actually leveraged ChatGPT go through a whole brainstorming activity and exercise to ultimately establish product principles for our particular property, breakout a number of different naming options based off of land features and animals within our general community. Used it to do over 30 different combinations with different apartment suffixes, and then use DALL-E to, which is a visual AI solution to actually generate a number of conceptual logos and designs. Wow. And we used all that to ultimately come on the final names for both of these particular projects and the final logos for them. Did that all in about 3 days.
Wow.
So we're really excited. We're actually going to be unveiling the name of that project here on social in like a couple days, but I'll give everybody a quick peek on that. It'll be the Meadowlark is what we landed with, because it's actually a natural bird in that area, but that community is named Meadow Park. Nice. And we wanted to find a way to be able to kind of connect the dots by seeming similar but also unique. So
man, I love that. I love that, man. So for what's the exit strategy for the 63 units? Do you plan to sell or do you plan to keep?
Great question. Great question. So, we plan to keep these. These will be in the family, 20 some, 30 some plus years. My son may end up, playing a big role with this in the long run when it's all said and done. I'll give you a little bit of like how we think about what we keep and what we sell. And it's actually, this is probably one of the most important lessons I've learned, is one, I think a lot of people got really big into the whole passive income, messaging as it relates to real estate. And that makes sense as like your North Star. Like I want to get to passive income. Mm-hmm. Right. But a lot of people don't realize that is, that's not necessarily what you want to do in the beginning. And so a good example is if I was to buy just a single house and say, I'm going to keep that, I'm going to rent that, and that's going to be my passive income. Well, generally, you might cash flow, only about $200 or $300 a month on a single family house. And generally speaking, that's not going to replace your full-time job. Mm-hmm. Yep. And generally speaking, there are some rules within the banking industry that make it difficult to get more than six loans on houses without having to get into some of the more complex asset management elements of how we get to that part. And so I sat down, I said to myself, man, all right, if I'm cash flowing $200 a month, that might help with a cell phone bill. But I'm not retiring off of that any point in time. And the pace, every time I get a new house, it adds to my debt, which adds to my debt to income ratio, which makes me look less advantageous as someone for a bank to invest in. And so one of the things I learned really early is actually you want to scale that money as fast as possible. I always talk about it as like the snowball effect, right? My wife and I, we've never spent any dollar that we made from any of our real estate. As soon as we sold our first property, we then took that money and we rolled that into new real estate. And then as we would sell the next thing, we'd take that and we snowball that into even more real estate. And we continue to grow it and continue to grow it and continue to grow it. And here's the why, right? Let's say I wanted to retire on $200,000 a year. Let's say to be able to retire and legit have $200,000 of passive income coming in, let's say you had that money in dividends, right? Because that's not really where you only can have true passive income. Real estate's generally not passive. Yeah. that's a very well known fact. There's not a lot of set it and forget it money in real estate, unfortunately. You will still be working on things. But let's say I put it in a 4% dividend, right? In order for you to ultimately have enough money in the bank at a 4% dividend, if my math is correct, I want to say it's $5 million you need to have in a 4% dividend in order to be able to generate $200,000 in passive income. And that's not including any other cash that you want to have on the side doing XYZ, right? that is, that alone is where I started realizing to myself, man, that's what I'm trying to get to at minimum. If I need to be able to have 5 million in the bank that I can have, just making its own money. And when you think about it, that's really what you're trying to do. You're trying to scale that money as fast as possible. You want to try to shorten that timeline as much as possible. Take that big chunk and then drop that over into something that's going to provide you passive income.
Yeah.
So scale up and then take that money and then put that into a larger multifamily. Yeah. And so that's what informs oftentimes our exit strategy. I'm young enough where right now I'm constantly, most of what I build, I'm selling with one caveat. Once we can get it to a big enough multifamily where, that the particular cash flow, for that, particular property is hitting, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, per year. Now that's actually worth me keeping. Yeah. And in addition, it's also large enough where I can have an on-site, property manager, who can ensure that that property is being maintained at the level necessary to ensure that this property continues to be the quality that we want it to be, continues to maintain the tenants that we want to have there over the course of the next 20, 30 years. So,
man, I love that. A lot to unpack there.
Yes.
No, you're good. It was amazing. So one of the things that I really appreciate that you mentioned, which is contrary to what a lot of people think, you know, everyone wants to go for that passive income. Yeah. And, you know, to your point, it's harder. It can be harder to scale. But if you're, you know, adding value to the property, selling them and just kind of rolling it into bigger and bigger opportunities.
Yep.
Like you said, you can, I just want people to understand this. You can shorten that timeline.
That's right? Exactly.
And you can
the goal.
Position yeah. yourself for that big cash windfall, which can enable you to either build that big property where you can get that passive income from, or yep. To buy that property, you know,
exactly.
And I think that's not a conversation that happens a lot.
It's not.
A lot of people talk about, you know, buying a property, never selling, you know, keeping it for the long term, which is fine, but yeah. I think it's important for people to look at the other side of it and see what could be done if you scale up, if you add value to the properties, you sell them higher and just keep, you know what I'm saying, repeating that process.
Well, and I think it also tied into what you just said is there's some underlying mindset stuff that's involved in this, right? We got to remember, for many of us as people of color coming from families that were historically disadvantaged, that did not have money, debt was often used to harm us.
Yeah.
Right. There are a lot of us as Black people, who are afraid of debt, right? We can go all the way back to sharecropping, where debt was used to keep us on the plantation and keep us effectively working for free past, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation, right? That is a huge thing for us to unpack. And it is incredibly, a tough thing for us to realize is actually the complete opposite about how those who make the most amount of money in real estate are able to do so. And that's thinking of debt as leverage, thinking of debt as a good thing and not as a bad thing. There is debt as a bad thing, but that's when you're buying depreciating assets. That's when you're buying a car on debt, you know? That's when you run up that Nordstrom bill too high, you know? But when it comes to appreciating assets, houses, one could say artwork, and one of the ones I talk about all the time, education. When you are taking out a student loan to be able to go to college, that actually is you investing in the right type of debt, because you yourself are an appreciating asset. You will be a better person 4 years after having gone to college than having not been there before, right? Recognizing that I can leverage other people's money at 4%, I know now 8%, we'll say 4%. And then I can go and get a return at 32%, and I can arbitrage, and I can effectively net that 28% difference. That's how the entire financial economy is effectively works. But part of how we are kept out of that system is by messaging that continuously communicates that debt is a bad thing. And so when we go back to the buy and hold strategy question, right? A lot of people say, oh, I'm just going to hold this property. I'm just going to pay it off. And my happiest moment was when that's entirely paid off. That's not always, and more often than not, that's typically not the right approach. Because my question, whenever I look at my money or when I look at any money that we're borrowing, my question is always, am I getting the highest and best returns on that money? It's called the velocity of money, right? And so if I have money in a property, actually just sold a condo last week, and it was a condo that we had bought during COVID. My wife and I renovated our house. We moved into it. We bought the condo, lived in it for a while. We moved out of it and we Airbnb'd it for a little over 2-3 years. And effectively was talking to my wife. I said, look, this money that we have stuck there, it's not making money. It's making some good money, but it's not meeting the type of returns that I know I could be making if this money was freed up and in a different asset. Mm-hmm. And so that was the reason why we decided to sell. Let's take the, you know, 80,000 or so that we're going to make on that. Let's go then put that into something that could be used where I can effectively be earning. So across my properties on average, my average IRR is about 133%. So which means that when I believe I find a deal, I generally believe that I can get 133% return on my money, on an annual basis. Compare that, if I'm borrowing at 4%, there's really no question on why I should ever, should not be constantly leveraging in order to be able to do that, continue scaling my money, exponentially as opposed to linearly. So
definitely love that, man. And so the 63 units, is it, will those be market rate units?
Yeah. So this is going to be at 100% AMI, which AMI is annual median income for our particular community. So these will be primarily market rates. We will work to do some unit based vouchers within our community as well. I'm a big proponent of mixed income housing. Again, it goes back to my experience, my time in the classroom. You see some of the best gains from students when you have the mix across multiple different levels and they're working with each other and they're learning from each other. And I think the same thing applies to communities, that we need diverse communities with diverse mindsets and backgrounds and income levels. We kind of have a little saying, you know, our housing is for all ages, all stages, and all wages.
Love that.
And so we try to ensure that we build with that in mind. That will end up being, we believe we'll probably be between, you know, 80 to 120% AMI on that, roughly right around 100%. So
love it. Talk to us a little bit about the 30, I think you said 36 units. That's yeah. Kind of down the road.
Yeah. Half a mile down the road. We are currently just wrapping up a mechanical rough in on those. Again, a lot of the same features that I spoke to earlier, you know, Samsung, 33-inch, you know, French door, refrigerators, right? We have mini splits. This has been a big thing in Seattle. Seattle of all cities has the lowest percentage of houses with air conditioning. Because we are just super temperate. We're 40 degrees in the winter. We're 80 degrees in the summer. And we're pretty mm-hmm. much always in between those year round. Mm-hmm. But you know, global warming is a real thing. And it's getting hot at time in the summer. So all of our units will have AC. That's been a really important thing. We also are doing tankless water heaters in all of ours, so we can increase the amount of space, more storage space for all of our tenants as well. And then, you know, EV chargers that we talked about, 9-foot ceilings, quartz countertops, you name it, right? So we're doing all the things. Tiled showers and tiled tubs, which in apartment units, that's not typically and always done. Mm-hmm. But we know, again, it adds just that additional nice level of feel and ambiance to it. And we like to do it. So, yeah,
definitely,
it's for our community.
Absolutely. What's like the estimate of the overall budget for those, I think it's 99?
Yeah. So generally, we're going to come in right around, I want to say a little bit over $150,000 per unit.
Gotcha.
Let me pull out my phone. Calculate. I got what my dollars per square foot is looking like is probably the question I'm thinking about in terms of our total cost. So for the I think we're going to be in at about $176 a square foot.
Gotcha.
In terms of our overarching cost to build.
Gotcha.
Which is fantastic. That's very hard to achieve.
Yeah.
And when we were talking with our bankers, they now have a construct, when you're doing properties of the size, they have a constructability arm mm-hmm. where they have a team that comes in, assesses what the numbers you've put together, and they say, hey, you're saying it's being built for this much. Based off of our understanding, we think it's going to be this much, right? For our particular project, there was a difference in what they thought it was going to cost for us to be able to build it. They had us at $14 million. That's an important thing, because in the event that amount, if we end up having to go up to that $14 million, then we have to put more of our own capital in, because remember, it's a percentage of the overarching construction that becomes mm-hmm. your down payment. And so we're over here, we had, banging the table saying, no, we believe we can build it at this price point. We showed multiple other projects we've done that have been built similarly at that same price point. And luckily they sided with us on that, And in the long run, we're going to have debt out on that. We're lucky we're able to tie up a fantastic construction to perm financing that's going to keep us, below 4% on that particular multifamily, because we got it all done back before the interest rates, went up. And so, all of these different variables. This is, like I said, when you're a developer, you're thinking about all of these different pieces and trying to bring it all together to create magic in this one, instance. So.
Definitely, man. Construction to perm. I haven't heard of that before. What's that?
Yeah, construction to perm financing. Essentially, it's where you work with a bank and you say, look, we want to build this. We already have the existing property. They say, all right, what we'll do is we'll give you a construction loan. And at the same time, we'll have already figured out and we'll have approved you for your permanent financing afterwards.
Wow.
Essentially it converts from a construction loan into permanent financing. Because typically construction loans, oftentimes construction loans can end up having variable rates. Oftentimes construction loans have, 12-month terms. So what this does is this just helps to, ease a little bit, in terms of knowing that you have your financing already secured. You're not going to have to refinance out your construction loan, at the end of the whole build cycle.
Yeah.
Your financing is already in place. So
definitely makes a whole lot of sense. I'm learning a whole lot today, man.
Yeah.
So talk to us a bit about your family history. I know your dad is in the development space and has been a tremendous influence on you. So we'd love to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah. I'm super blessed. So I'm half Haitian. My dad is from Haiti. Sac passé. He's born out of Port-au-Prince and he immigrated into Brooklyn. My grandpa was in construction and was a handyman. And I think very much influenced my dad. He went to Washington University in St. Louis, got his degree from there, and then he bought his first property, realized the light, the magic came on in his eyes when he said, wait, like, I'm adding up these numbers. And when I look at these numbers, they're saying that this is possible. And it was like, this is what I need to be doing. At the time, he had actually, ironically, man, I swear I'm not trying to be my dad, but he was a teacher at the time.
No way. That's so funny.
Yeah. He was working at a school out in St. Louis at the time. And long story short, it's also where he met my mom. My mom is like one of my just biggest inspirations. So I gotta give a quick shout out to her story as well.
Yeah.
Born on the west side of Chicago, grew up on the south side of Chicago, with four brothers and sisters. She went to Wash U in St. Louis. Again, it's one of the top schools in the country. Was getting her undergrad in engineering. Realized that the Duke Medical School program at that time didn't have a bachelor's degree requirement. They actually just had a credit requirement, and so she never actually graduated from undergrad. Joined Duke for med school, went and got her degree as an MD.
Wow.
And then went off to start a 20-year private practice as an obstetrics gynecologist without having her undergrad. The only reason why I tell that story is because it came back to bite her, because she actually ended up moving into being the chief physician's officer for MultiCare up in the state of Washington. And at the time they were like, man, you know, we love you for this role. You're more than qualified for it, but technically this role requires you to get a bachelor's degree, to have a bachelor's degree, and you don't technically have it. So they sent her down to USC out here in your backyard to get her master's and MBA to shore her up on the underlying requirement, all paid for on the dime. So I got to show a shout out because she is just an unbelievable, accomplished woman. Amazing, and between both of them, they have been just the biggest influences in my life. Both my parents ultimately were entrepreneurs. I think that's also played a big role as well. So,
man, that's amazing. What was it like for your dad when he started developing properties?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it very much was just, again, is realizing and understanding that is actually, this is a formula. This is a number. These are numbers you can input and you can output. And realizing it's also a game of relationships, ensuring that you have the right people, the right subs, the right financing partners, the right consultants, bringing them together around a shared vision. Man, we're going to have to get him down here one of these days.
I know, we got to do part two, man.
His story and the things that he knows and the wisdom that he speaks continuously shape the work that I do. I always joke with them. I say, look, I've never had my dad give me, you know, any money for investing, you know, but my dad is definitely, I co-invest with my dad currently in deals.
Yeah.
You know, my dad regularly call me up, Dom, I found this property. Do you want to co-invest in this with me? Yeah. And even the 63 unit that we're doing right now is a joint venture between him, myself, and my youngest sister.
It's amazing, man.
And so, it's really, my dad has always had this vision of Black wealth and of leaving a long-term legacy of success. And, for the longest, I tried to fight him, and I didn't want to do what he did. You know, I grew up as a kid, literally in the back seat, going with him from property to property to property, checking in on, is this being done correctly? We're over in Framing over here, having to go to the bank with him to go sign a check, you know? And I was like, man, I don't want to do what this dude is doing. I want to live my own life. I want to demonstrate my own capabilities. And I went off and I did that. I was a teacher for 3 years. I was a professor for 3 years. I was in tech for 11 years. But I ultimately ended up realizing, I was like, man, when you just break it down, you look at the numbers and you look at the goal is to be wealthy. You're not getting there without real estate. It's too advantaged by so many other elements. No other asset has the same elements, the same fundamentals as real estate does. The ability to use leverage, right? You know, it's only recently you've been able to, to buy stocks on credit, right? The ability to have all of the tax elements that are a part of real estate. To be able to reduce your overarching taxable income. Fact that it's very hard for a property to go to zero, where that's not the case for stocks, or for your angel investment in somebody else's company, right? So there's just a lot of little elements and details there. I think that that he embedded in me this whole time without me really realizing it. And then once I finally, heard the music, it all kind of made sense. And I was able to go out there and really chart my own path. So.
Love it, man. I got to get up to Seattle, man. I got to get up and meet him and get up and see some of your projects
in real time. We're going to have you out. So
definitely, man, this has been an amazing interview, man. I wish we had like 2-3 hours, but no,
you got
things going on, man, but definitely, Dom, appreciate you coming on the show. This was a lot of fun. My wheels are turning, man. It's crazy. I always get so many new ideas listening to people like you talk, man. So Dom, before we go, let the people know where they can find you, follow you, keep up with you, reach out to you.
Yeah, man. Keep up with me. I'm pretty active right now in real estate Twitter, retweet as I often talked about. You can find me on Twitter at Real Dom Remy. And then on Instagram, just at Dominique Remy. That's where you'll see me post regularly photos of our projects under construction. issues that we're navigating, friction that we're going through, and then those big wins, those big moments when everything comes together and just like, yes, like we're winning right now. So I try to keep that up to date with all of the property stuff that we're doing and just showing the real side. I own like 8 different short-term rentals. You know, we have things go wrong with our tenants. We have to call, you know, we have a water heater that breaks down. You know, there's, you know, someone complains that, you know, that they wish there were some blinds in the living room. So, you know, we figure that all out, and I kind of document all of it for myself and for my son and for others as well. So I want to make sure that as we, you know, I love what you're doing on here, man, so much.
Thanks, bro.
I love it. I love it. I love it. It's so important that we as Black people are able to see other individuals doing things that we all aspire to. And so I've realized I have to be a better proponent of sharing my story and the idea that ultimately inspires others to be able to get to the same place. So, and higher, if anything.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Appreciate it again. And thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Black Real Estate Dialogue. Make sure you like, subscribe, and share. If you're on YouTube, if you're on audio, leave us that 5-star rating and review. Thank you all so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue, and be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.